Hey guys, and welcome back to the Continuing the Conversation podcast. I am super excited. This semester we are getting to walk through the Gospel of Matthew together. And as we talked about earlier, the first sermon in this series we're titling Jesus is King, Matthew is making that bold claim that Jesus is the son of Abraham, the son of David, and the Messiah. Son of Abraham, meaning that he is the fulfillment of God's mission and story through the people of Israel to reveal himself to a lost and dying world. He is the son of David, meaning he is the Davidic king whose kingdom is going to extend to the ends of the earth. And the Messiah, he is the anointed one who is going to, as we talked about in the sermon, going to crush the head of the enemy, going to crush the headship of the dominion of darkness. And he's going to do it through this sense of he will crush your head, but you will strike his heel. The way that he will crush the head of the enemy is through the self-sacrificial work of laying down his life on the cross. So that's a little bit about what we talked about in the sermon. Today we're going to look at Matthew chapter 2. And in full confession, typically I have a conversation partner. This time I'm just kind of flying solo. We're going to try to keep these podcasts to about 30 minutes an episode. Today, simply because it's just me, we're going to keep it a little shorter than usual. But so let's hit it. Let's kind of look at this Matthew chapter 2, which is essentially subdivided into three different sections, if you're looking at it with a modern translation like the NIV. And it starts out with this narrative of the Magi come from the east, and they are looking for the one who has been born King of the Jews. And of course, this scares King Herod, who is Herod the Great. One of the things to note is Matthew is, again, trying to make this claim that Jesus is the king who's worth following to the ends of the earth and to the depths of our soul. And of course, that would be scary for Herod, because Herod is what they would call a client king. In history, this Herod is known as Herod the Great. And he would be known as a client king. He was Idumean, which really probably puts him as a descendant of the Edomites, or Esau's line, rather than Jacob's line. And he would use that as kind of a, like, he is Israel's king, trying to kind of connect himself to the story of Israel. And of course, we know Esau is actually Israel's brother, not Israel. So when these Magi show up and say, where's the king who's been born king of the Jews? That would have been very unsettling for Herod, because he has been trying to posture himself or position himself as the king of the Jews. And then, of course, you get this prophecy that is pulled from Micah. One of the things I would encourage you to do as you read along with us this semester, when you see a prophecy from the Old Testament, look over, you know, on the page, and oftentimes they will show you where that text comes from. To really understand what the biblical writer is trying to say, it can be really helpful to just go back and look at how it's positioned in the original text. So we're going to do that. We're going to look at Micah chapter 5. I'm just going to read for you the first four verses. Marshal your troops now, city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem of Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come one from me, one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are of old, from ancient times. Therefore, Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor bears a son, and the rest of his brothers, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach the ends of the earth. So Micah is saying, okay, Jesus is that king. He's that king whose origins are from old, from ancient times. And that's one of the things that you'll begin to notice is, okay, yes, he is David's, he's of David's line. He's from that kind of olden time, but he's also from a much more ancient time. He is the Messiah. He is the head crusher that God spoke of even back in Genesis 3. And then, of course, the Magi bring these three gifts, which we are so used to seeing in these nativity plays, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And it can be so tempting to not even really grasp their prophetic significance. The gold represents Jesus' kingship. Gold was a gift for those of royalty. Frankincense was a tree sap that would make this kind of incense inside of a temple. So essentially, the Magi are saying, okay, you're the king with the gold, you're the priest with the frankincense. And then you get this very strange gift, the gift of myrrh. Myrrh that they would use on dead bodies to kind of cover the stench. What a weird gift to give to a baby and his mama and dad, the our earthly father, the sense of, okay, I'm giving you something to prepare for his burial. But right out of the gate, Matthew is really wanting us to grasp the fact that Jesus is going to become king, but he's going to become king through his death. And you're going to see that kind of line of thinking play out through the biblical narrative. Of course, they receive the warning to return a different way and not tell Herod where this king of the Jews is. Joseph has another dream, and that dream leads him to take Mary and the child down to Egypt to escape Herod, because Herod is going to seek to kill the child. And then you get this prophecy, out of Egypt I've called my son. And if you look at it, that comes from Hosea 11:1. As you turn to Hosea 11:1, you read, when Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt I called my son, but the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. But they did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them. Of course, he is drawing back on this mindset of God calling the people of Israel out of Egypt and caring for their needs by daily providing manna for them and quail and taking care of them as a people, being Israel's shepherd and Israel's God. And I think what Matthew wants you to recognize is, okay, God is doing it again. God is calling his people again out of this Egypt, this land of spiritual slavery that they have been in. And it's through the new and better and true Israel, who is Jesus. And then, of course, Herod becomes angry, and he gives orders to kill the boys in Bethlehem and the vicinity who are 2 years old and under. And of course, Matthew brings out this prophecy from Jeremiah. That comes from Jeremiah 31:15. A voice is heard in Ramah, mourning and great weeping. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And you read that and you think, okay, he's just talking about somehow this was predicted that these children would be killed. But there's more going on than just that. When you go back to Jeremiah and read all of 31, it begins with this kind of statement. It says, "At that time, declares the Lord, I will be the God of all the families of Israel, and they will be my people." This is what the Lord says. The people who survive the sword, in essence, survive the sword of Babylon, will find favor in the wilderness, and I will come to give rest to Israel. And you skip down to verse 8. There will be a day when watchmen cry out on the hills of Ephraim, "Come, let us go up to Zion to the Lord our God." Actually, that's verse 6. Verse 8 says, "See, I will bring them from the land of the north and will gather them to the ends of the earth. Among them will be the blind and the lame, expectant mothers, women in labor. A great throng will return. They will come with weeping. They will pray as I bring them back. I will lead them beside streams of water. On the level path they will not stumble, because I am Israel's father, and Ephraim is my firstborn son." Notice what's going on here. Jeremiah has made this claim about a voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children. And you think that this is simply about the horrible evil that Herod has inflicted upon these Jewish families and their children. But in some level, It is that, and it's also greater than that. It's exposing that Herod is not a true Israelite. He's killing Israelites. It's also revealing that part of God working in the midst of a really fallen, crazy world means that even in the midst of his redemptive work, There's counteraction, there's pushback, there's evil, there's dominion of darkness that's at war with God's plans and purposes. Don't lose hope that in the midst of such horrible evil, there is a good God who is still working to overcome such horrible evil. God is still has a plan that he is working out, even that will overcome the plans and the schemes of evil people and the evil one. Okay, and then finally you get to this last section where an angel appears to Joseph, lets him know that Herod is dead, and they are to return back home. But when they get to the land of Israel, they find out that Archelaus, his son, is reigning in Judea. And so, having been warned in a dream, they withdraw to the district of Galilee and went and lived in a town called Nazareth. And, of course, this sets Jesus up to be the Nazarene, the one who is called out of Nazareth. So, all right, that's a little bit of an overview. I want to hit two basic questions. How does this reveal Jesus to be king? Actually, three questions. How does this reveal Jesus to be king? How does this move the biblical narrative forward? And if you're working with somebody, helping them learn to walk with Jesus using this text, if you're having a cup of coffee with someone, how would you help someone become whole through Jesus with this text? Okay, how does it reveal Jesus to be king? Well, quite simply, it reveals that Herod is not. And that Jesus' kingship is, number one, it comes through the line of David, but it connects back, as the prophet Micah is showing us, to origins of ancient times. Secondly, it moves the biblical narrative forward because you're seeing that prophecies, sometimes when biblical writers draw on prophecies, sometimes they're drawing on prophecies that are truly predictive. They're saying, okay, yes, this guy is coming, and then bam, the writer wants you to know, okay, he's here. Jesus is here. Sometimes the biblical writers are pulling on prophecies of things that have already taken place, and they're simply saying, okay, in Jesus, God is doing the same thing again, and it's so much greater. You certainly find that in Matthew chapter 1 when Jesus is referred to, or when Matthew draws on Isaiah's prophecy about by the time that that the virgin will give birth to a son, and you will call him Emmanuel. It's, in some ways, that prophecy had already been fulfilled, and basically Matthew is saying, okay, the greater fulfillment, or the greater example of this, God is doing it again in Jesus. With some of these prophecies, the prophecies of Micah and Hosea and Jeremiah, I think they are a little more predictive. They're more like God is eventually going to do this, and then God actually does it in Jesus. I think you could make some arguments one way or the other, and I kind of don't want to declare that too authoritatively, because I'm sure we could get into it and kind of create some arguments on both sides of that as to whether they are predictive prophecies or whether they are prophecies that have already been fulfilled and then God is doing them again in the life of Jesus. In terms of how I would use this in a conversation with someone that I'm having coffee with and trying to help them become whole through Jesus. A, you just want to teach the text, teach what's actually going on, which we've kind of done in the last 15 minutes. But the other thing I would do is I would talk about how, in some ways, this challenges me to ask the question, are there places where a false king has been installed in my life? Are there places where things that may not actually be bad have gone from a place of I like them to they have kind of supreme sway in my life, where I honor them more than I honor Christ in my heart? Because in some ways, that's what's going on. The real king is showing up, and he's exposing who the false king is. So one of the ways you know if you have a false king, or what the Old Testament calls an idol, is when it gets exposed, how protective am I of it? Am I protective, or am I repentant? Do I protect its place of kingship in my life, or do I repent and say, okay, nope, Jesus is king? And that's a thing that I hope will become more and more clear as we walk through the book of Matthew. Certainly when we get to chapters 5-7, the Lord's going to reveal to us his vision of what kingdom ethics look like, and how we can live in accordance with his will and his desire by his grace, by his strength. And it's going to expose some places that we've wanted to say, okay, Jesus, I will follow you right up until this point. And that's when false kings or idols get exposed. And what we do in that time, whether we try to protect our idols or whether we surrender them to Jesus so that we can walk more fully in surrender to his kingship, that's a big deal. All right, guys, I hope this blessed you. We will catch you next time. Be blessed.